Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today is Annie Jacobson, investigative journalist and author of the newly released book, Nuclear War, A Scenario. Annie's investigative specialty is pulling back the curtain on parts of the national security state that lie outside of the public eye. She's written about CIA paramilitary operations during the War on Terror, Area 51, Operation Paperclip, which was the U.S. effort to recruit Nazi scientists during the Cold War immediately after World War II, and DARPA, the U.S. military's primary research agency. In Nuclear War Scenario, Annie focuses not on the before parts of nuclear conflicts, so not proliferation, not debates around the number of nukes we should have, not how nukes actually work, but she just focuses on how experts inside and outside the nuclear community, and of course, the broader military as a whole, consider how the U.S. and other powers would react to the use of a nuclear weapon. This is obviously a really heady and heavy topic, so this isn't an episode where I can just say, hey, hope you guys enjoy this one. But given the fact that we live in a world that's increasingly defined by the possibility of great powers with nuclear weapons standing in front of each other, much as they did during the Cold War, it's important that we understand this aspect of the nuclear policy debate. So hope you all get a lot from the conversation that I mentioned before, and a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Annie Jacobson, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me.
I read a lot of books for this show, and I think the opening of Nuclear War, A Scenario, is probably one of the most jarring I've ever read in the past 5 years. I'd love for you just to kind of begin by introducing the central concept and obviously unpacking the story that you're focusing on.
Thank you for that opening. I take that as high praise, because the fundamental underpinning this book is to show readers in appalling detail just how horrific a nuclear war would be. And for that reason, I open in a prologue form what happens later in the book when a 1 megaton thermonuclear weapon strikes the Pentagon in what is called a bolt out of the blue nuclear attack. And as multiple sources for the book told me, a bolt out of the blue nuclear attack, that is an unwarned nuclear strike, is what Washington, D.C. fears most.
And to understand, and I'll just make this very vivid and very clear for folks who haven't taken a look at the book yet. I lived in Washington, D.C. for a while, and I live in the kind of Austin suburbs / exurbs. So I find myself thinking, as someone who works in national security spaces, oh, you know, you're this close to the Pentagon. You're that far away from downtown Austin, which is almost certainly on various nuclear targeting lists. How far away would you have to be to survive? And I think what becomes so clear in that opening articulation of what a 1 megaton strike would actually look like is you basically just have no means of survival. Is that a good way of understanding it?
I think it is. I mean, I describe in detail about people turning into combusting carbon. I describe in detail how when you see a nuclear mushroom cloud, let's say in the movies, the contents of that mushroom cloud are actually humans and things, because that is what happens to people and things in a very large radius going out from ground zero, depending on the size of the bomb. And one thing I think is important and sort of shocking to remind readers of this book right away is that all of the effects that I describe in this book are not from Annie Jacobson's imagination. They are from actual Defense Department documents, because ever since the first two atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, U.S. defense scientists have spent all these decades compiling in great detail what nuclear weapons do to people and things. Because, and again, here's another shocker, when these nuclear war plans first came into fruition in the 1950s, the idea, as insane as it is, was that we would actually fight to win a nuclear war. That has, of course, since changed because everyone realizes that once nuclear war happens, it ends in apocalypse. So now the idea is deterrence. The idea is, oh, we're never going to have a nuclear war, but we still have the same arsenals of nuclear weapons pointed at the other side so that no one dares start a nuclear war.
I think something I was just wondering in that opening story, you talk about how within 60 seconds, the Pentagon's gone, the Joint Base Anacostia is gone, the Defense Intelligence Agency is gone, so much of our infrastructure is gone. And I'm just wondering, thinking through that framework, it's kind of weird that after World War II, we didn't decentralize Washington itself, given the prospects of how much destruction would happen in just those first 60 seconds. I'm curious if you've thought about that at all. Like the way we've designed our capital, does it make any sense from a redundancy and resiliency perspective if we're fearing a nuclear conflict?
I mean, you're absolutely right. And yet there is redundancy in nuclear strikes. It's why we have a nuclear triad. It's why we have ICBMs in underground silos. It's why we have nuclear armed, nuclear powered submarines, you know, going around stealthily in the oceans. And it's why the third part of the triad are the nuclear bombers. Like, so there's redundancy for you just in case, you know, one weapon system gets taken out by an enemy. There's a backup and a backup of the backup. And yet you're absolutely right. All power is centralized in DC. And we can get into later about what that means for this idea of continuity of government. But on a detail, I had the moment that you had realizing that when I was looking at these nuclear command bunkers, right? So there is three central nuclear command bunkers that go into play immediately in seconds after a nuclear launch is detected. And of course, the Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado is very legendary in as much as that it's appeared in films. And then of course, there's the Pentagon, and people may or may not know that there is a nuclear bunker beneath the Pentagon called the National Military Command Center. But there's a third bunker underneath Strategic Command. And that is located in Omaha, Nebraska, beneath Offutt Air Force Base. And I had that thought that you had about the decentralization of, you know, power in DC, because the reason that that headquarter bunkers was positioned there in the middle of the country was because when these plans first came to be and the ICBM had yet to be invented, the idea was that the Soviet Union would attack the United States with nuclear weapons in bomber planes. And if you had a bunker in the middle of the country, it would give a little bit of lead time for us to get our bombers out. Because of course, Omaha, Nebraska is in the middle of the country. And the idea was that the radars would pick up the incoming planes on the East and West Coast. And so, you know, we all, in learning about this subject, have those little aha moments, which are really more like, oh shit.
How does one internalize the horror of the situation you describe in the opening and basically not just collapse into despair? And I want to give context for that. So for example, during the 1930s, there were overheated thoughts about the power of the bomber. So the phrase was like, the bomber will always get through. And if you're looking at Charles Lindbergh and a lot of like the pessimists in the face of Hitler, they were saying things like, well, ultimately London's doomed because the Nazis will just bomb it to smithereens with the Luftwaffe. And, you know, appeasement is therefore the correct answer. So I could see a situation where, you know, and you in many ways start the story in 1960. If that story and this understanding of our policy were to leak, and I were to read it in 1961, it'd be very hard for me to support JFK during the Berlin crisis, where we decide, okay, we're going to risk a conflict with the Soviets over our decision to continue to maintain our position in West Berlin. So how do we balance both the horror with the fact that the logical conclusion of this could inevitably be, we should always appease and we should always back down from any threat?
I mean, that is a central paradox of the whole problem of deterrence and the problem of nuclear weapons themselves. But on the front part of your question, I think, was how do you not read a book like this and just become incredibly despondent? How do you not think about nuclear weapons and not just say, you know, I want to throw in the towel? But I actually think it's quite the opposite, and here's why. So I have previously written 6 books on military and intelligence programs, the CIA, the Pentagon, DARPA, all of which, all of my sources, and I have like approximately 100 sources per book, have said to me, everything I did was to prevent nuclear World War III. And so this book raises the question, what would happen if deterrence failed, if prevention failed, and if we actually had nuclear World War III? And the reason why it's hopeful as opposed to, you know, leaves you feeling very despondent has to do with what I call the Reagan reversal. Okay. And that's actually a common term in Washington. And it goes like this. Back in 1983, when I was actually in high school, there was a mini series on television on ABC called The Day After. And it was a fictional scenario of war between the United States and then Soviet Russia. ABC was encouraged not to air it. That's how controversial it was. That's how terrifying it was. And they did. And 100 million Americans watched it. And among the people who saw that miniseries was President Ronald Reagan. And he wrote in his journal that he got greatly depressed. His words. But because he was president, he could actually do something. He reached out to Gorbachev. They communicated. They ended up having a summit. And the result of their communicating, the result of their seeing the horror, imagining what could happen, knowing this is all fact-based, those two individuals, those two leaders, were responsible for the reduction in nuclear weapons from the all-time high of 70,000 nuclear warheads. That number is so absurd. I'm going to repeat it. 70,000 nuclear warheads. Down to today, what are approximately 12,500 nuclear warheads. You might say that's 12,500 too many. But it certainly is a beginning, and it demonstrates the central point here, which is that I believe information is king. The more you know, the more you can become agitated, and the more chance to reduce the threat of this madness.
Thinking about that story, it's an interesting one. I'll just note, I saw The Day After it was on TV back in the 2000s, and even then, really aged well from a pure, it's so well done. It makes you kind of lament the fact that we just don't live in a world where you could just have like basic cable miniseries that have that level of budget and quality and have 100 million people tune in. There's just no world where in any environment people would tune into something like that. But I guess I wonder if you're looking at that story about the 80s when it comes to hope, it seems as if the fundamental, and this is why, you know, that early opening to Gorbachev was controversial. The serious debate was, is Gorbachev truly a reformer? Is he a good faith actor? Does he concede that the way the Soviet Union behaved in the 60s and 70s was no longer sustainable? That all ended up being correct, and therefore the Reagan opening was the right move. But do you worry that when it comes to the Iranians or Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping, that we just lack the same partner on the other side of the equation that gives us hope from the 80s example?
The alternative is simply not sustainable, right? To just simply have increasingly vitriolic conversations with your adversaries and enemies only leads to one place: were nuclear weapons to actually be used. And so my position is fundamentally, at the end of the day, everyone comes down to, you know, wanting to continue to live their life. I mean, unless you're an absolute madman, and we have to get into that scenario. And I certainly do bring that up in nuclear war scenario, but I can't imagine that communication is anything other than a good thing. Separate from what you believe are people's intentions, the alternative is unsustainable.
You know, something I wonder, speaking of the madman scenario, early in the war in Ukraine after Russia's invasion, there was a lot of bandied about talk about the use of tactical nuclear weapons by Russia in terms of Crimea and in terms of deterring NATO forces from intervening beyond just supplying weaponry and training during that early spring, late summer period. My conclusion was always, and it was wild because I was doing daily coverage of the war on this show. So I'd sometimes get calls from listeners and they'd be despondent that, you know, the war was going to end. And my reaction was always, well, it would be insane to utilize a nuclear weapon over even Crimea. Therefore, and the American policy was very specifically premised on not putting boots on the ground, which would invoke that level. So I was never particularly concerned about the nuclear escalation from that perspective. I'm curious how you thought through the year 2022, given the fact that you're writing a book like this.
And as you've seen, those threats have only escalated. The rhetoric has gotten more menacing. Vladimir Putin has said that he is not joking about the possibility of using WMD, weapons of mass destruction. He now regularly refers to the possibility of tactical nuclear weapons. He even said just a couple days ago, weapons are to be used. If that isn't a menacing threat, I don't know. Kim Jong-un has accused the United States of a sinister intention to provoke nuclear war. And so with all these threats abounding, coupled with what I learned in reporting the book of just how fast nuclear war would unfold, how quickly it would spiral out of control. Again, my position is communication is absolutely imperative.
You know, something I'm curious about, you have a quote at the start of the book where you say that the generals and the nuclear experts you've spoken to all agree with the statement, there's no such thing as a small nuclear war or use of a nuclear weapon that could just be isolated. And part of what makes this difficult when we're looking at the Russian side of things is that, at least as we've understood this in a popular culture, the Russians kind of conceive of nuclear weapons, especially tactical ones, as in slightly different means than we do, in the sense that at a certain point, a tactical nuclear weapon from their perspective could be considered to just be like a bigger form of artillery or a bigger munition than is traditionally used, but still within the, you know, realm of something that could be used tactically on the battlefield and not necessarily invoke, 40 megatons hitting Moscow. How do you understand, and to your point about communication, the differences in conception of nuclear weapons between the parties that should be speaking, so the US, China, Russia, et cetera?
Might be helpful for us to clarify for listeners the difference between tactical nuclear weapons and strategic nuclear weapons, right? Because so the
thank you for doing my job, by the way.
No. But you know, this is what I also find really important about all of this is that the conversation about nuclear weapons has, like, prior to sort of the right now moment of it, had just sort of evaporated. And I think it's in part because it's something that people don't want to think about. But it also has to do with the fact, to my eye, that a lot of these issues have gotten sidelined over to sort of the PhD crowd, the pundits who have kind of advanced nomenclature around this and esoteric ideas, and they talk policy and they seem to almost suggest that the rest of us don't know. And I find that and have always found that, you know, unacceptable, because knowledge is for everyone. I write books that are popular. You know, the joke is sometimes that I'm read by the generals at the Pentagon, but also the little old ladies in North Dakota. And the reason being is I want to make these very complex issues simple because they affect all of us. And so a great example would be tactical versus strategic weapons. Tactical weapons, it's like, you're absolutely right. The way you described it, it's just saying, oh, it's going to be used on the battlefield. It's just a bigger munition. A bigger bomb. Strategic weapons is a lovely euphemism for essentially ballistic missile weapons that have the capacity to move from one continent to another in 30 minutes. So they launch up into the atmosphere and then they fly at around 500 to 700 miles above the Earth in what is called mid-course phase. And then they re-enter the atmosphere and they detonate on a target. And it's the speed with which that happens. It's that it takes actually 26 minutes and 40 seconds from a launch pad in Russia to hit a target on the East Coast. It takes 33 minutes from a launch pad in Pyongyang to hit a target on the East Coast. Again, math that was done for me for this book so that readers could really understand the specifics involved in a non, you know, elitist way, in just a regular people way. And so your question is like, I think your question is, how would those two scenarios differ? Well, as I show in the book, what we know from at least one of the declassified nuclear war games, and they are very rarely declassified, but one called Proud Prophet was declassified. And we learn from that that when these scenarios are run, they do different scenarios. Okay, with NATO involved, with NATO not involved. Let's involve China, let's not involve. And no matter how the scenario of nuclear war begins, it ends only one way, and that is in nuclear apocalypse.
So separating the strategic and the tactical, I think it's easy to understand how a strategic use of a nuclear weapon would lead to apocalypse, because like once it's launched, everyone has to launch once the launch happens. But if we think of the tactical scenario where, let's imagine the worst case scenario happened in 2022, the September offensive is going particularly well, and Ukrainian forces appear poised to take a serious portion of Crimea, and there's panic in Russia, and they use a tactical nuclear weapon in that scenario on the battlefield. How do folks who you've spoken to see a usage like that extending beyond they just used a big bomb to actually the only answer is further escalation that ends in apocalypse?
And I don't address that in my book for a specific reason, because it's super dangerous, right? So it is incredibly dangerous for anyone to open up a nuclear arsenal and use it. Why I specifically chose a bolt out of the blue attack was because I wanted to show in, you know, detail, factual detail, how nuclear war is a system. It is a sequence of events. A follows B follows C. Protocols and procedures that automatically go into effect in the event that America is attacked with a nuclear weapon. And so the tactical weapon concept exists outside the lane of what I am absolutely confident to speak on. And I did that for a reason, because once you cross that line, I think all bets about deterrence are off the table. And to remind listeners again, deterrence is this idea, which is so Orwellian to me in its fundamentals, which is that nuclear weapons keep us safer. That's the essential concept of deterrence. We have our arsenal pointed at the enemy. And our ready-to-launch arsenal, by the way, is 1,770 nuclear weapons that are forward deployed. We have several thousand more on reserve. Russia has approximately the same, 1,670. The numbers change, you know, annually, and that's where it gets into that really wonky esoteria of people correcting one another. But you get the idea, right? So those arsenals, the fundamental of deterrence is, I've got all my swords pointed at you. You've got all your swords pointed at me. No one dares flinch. And so far, that has kept us out of nuclear war. The idea of using a tactical weapon would be analogous to, you know, somebody pulling a double-edged, you know, a knife out of their pocket and stabbing the guy with the swords. In other words, what happens to all the swords is anyone's guess.
And I understand the Orwellian logic to your critique of deterrence policy, but it's also just true. So, for example, the reason why you couldn't just do the bolt scenario and launch a surprise attack is that you couldn't, or at least within the conception of deterrence, you couldn't win. Like, there's no such thing as like, look, if we just take a risk and we launch this nuclear strike and we take out Washington, you know, chance it doesn't work, but we're more likely than not to like survive this and defeat our enemy. Deterrence, especially via the nuclear triad, makes that impossible. And I can't remember the name of this play, but there's a play where there's a, where one of the lines, it's a kind of a rip off of, it's a play off of a Shakespeare play where one of the characters said, you know, at some point we could have said no. And my kind of concern as I'm thinking about that concept here is, I think we're probably past that point where we could say no. I'm curious, you recounting this history, do you think there was ever a point that, and maybe you reject my premise that it's too late to say no, quote unquote, but was there ever a point where you think we could have said no, quote unquote? And I'm curious how you'd think about that.
Talk about an exercise in humility, right? To have to look back through the lens of history and consider that. And for that exact reason, I take the reader through a part of the book before the actual launch begins, which is, you know, how we got here in essence. And I demonstrate in numbers very quickly the nuclear buildup. And I think that, so if you look at those years, 1949, 1950, 1951, the amount of weapons that we had, you see that point of no return very quickly coming and going. And it pretty much is right around the time of 1949 when America is no longer the only nation with a nuclear weapon. Once Russia had a nuclear weapon, the buildup became so frantic and so fast and so colossal that there is no turning back from the amount of weapons. What we just spoke of about the Reagan and Gorbachev issues suggests otherwise. But what I think is worthy of debate is what you said, like the idea that, you know, deterrence will hold. Of course it will hold. Well, again, what if it doesn't? And it's not just Annie Jacobson who's asking that question, because I found what is probably the most haunting quote in that keeps me up at night. And it comes from the deputy commander of STRATCOM. For listeners, Strategic Command is the most important military organization you might have never heard of. They control the nukes. They are the ones responsible for, the commander of STRATCOM is responsible for executing the launch order once he gets it from the president. And the deputy commander of STRATCOM spoke, it was not classified, but he was speaking to insiders and they were talking about deterrence. And his quote, the exact quote is in the book, I'm paraphrasing, but it was along the lines of, deterrence works, but if deterrence fails, it all unravels. And that word unravels, unraveling is his. And that concept is what I find terrifying. And that is the sort of center point of nuclear war scenario. The unraveling happens in seconds and minutes, and the world ends in hours, not in days and weeks and months.
And now, a quick word about the A16Z podcast. Hey, it's Marshall. In an exponential era, it's more important than ever for our country to have alignment between policymakers, founders, and funders. However, it's rare that we find all of them in the same room. Luckily, the A16Z podcast from Andreessen Horowitz just dropped a brand new series on American dynamism focused on exactly this. Coined by Realignment friend and A16Z general partner Catherine Boyle, American dynamism is a movement that embodies the spirit of innovation, and this new four-part series, recorded in the heart of Washington, D.C., covers topics including intelligence in the era of AI, the nuclear renaissance, and the future of defense. Guests include the CIA's first ever chief technology officer, Nand Mulchandani, the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy, Dr. Catherine Huff, and Director of the DoD's Defense Innovation Unit, Doug Beck. Not to mention the founders of ambitious companies rivaling the status quo, like microreactor company Radiant, AI pilot company Shield AI, and advanced autonomous systems company Anduril. So don't miss out. Go check out the A16Z podcast and their new series on American dynamism on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. You know, something I'm really proud of is, you know, this is a niche podcast, but we have a real listenership on the Hill and in the White House. I would like to know, like, if you're in that part, if you're speaking to that part of the audience, what do you think policymakers should take away from this conversation? What do you want the conclusion to be as someone's looking at the increasingly fractious geopolitical moment? Like, mm-hmm. what should their conclusion be coming out of this?
Well, certainly, if you have a more hard, shall we say, hawkish, you know, approach to all of this, you might see the idea of more communication, more diplomacy as Pollyanna-ish, right? You know, using poetics here. But on a very practical side, there's another part of communication, and that has to do with science and technology. One of the things I found shocking, speaking of the Ukraine war, right? So in November of 2022, one of the new American news organizations erroneously reported that a Russian missile had struck Poland. And that is, of course, a political and a potential, you know, operational nightmare because of Article 5 of NATO. You attack one of us, you attack all of us. And it turned out to be erroneous, but for, I don't know, 24, 36 hours, it was still considered a viable reportage. And General Milley, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, gave a press conference 36 hours later and said that he had not been able to reach his Russian counterpart. And so to answer your question, what could be done? Communication on the face-to-face human level of all of this, to pull back from the edge of rhetoric and threat, on the one hand, I believe in, and communication as a technical issue, meaning get a system whereby leaders can absolutely pick up the phone and call one another. There's no reason why General Milley doesn't have the cell phone number of his Russian counterpart, you know, on speed dial.
I guess what I wonder, though, is the Russians benefited from the ambiguity of that situation, because from a nuclear escalation perspective, no one in the West or NATO said, even when people believed the news reporting, okay, a missile struck, the, you know, match has been lit, the dominoes have been pushed, you know, have been knocked down, launch a nuclear strike on Moscow. The first step. So what I'm saying then is, like, it's not us that would be introducing the nuclear escalation. Therefore, from a Russian perspective, the lack of communications is actually an advantage. It's good to have the Biden administration say, okay, so we are going to send F-16s, but because we're not sure about Russian escalation, the F-16s are going to come on this sort of delayed timeline. And actually, they have to stay, like, within the boundaries of Ukraine. And by the way, I support both of those policies. But it just seems to be that's, like, the communications difficulty, because it seems that because we weren't actively fighting a conflict in the Cold War, in especially those 80s period, I mean, Afghanistan's complicated, but we weren't actively fighting a conflict in the same way we were fighting the war in Ukraine. It seems like there was a benefit on both sides to transparency and communication, and we just lack that now. So I'm just curious, like, how do you suggest one gets around that failure point?
I don't write about the policy leading up to nuclear war a scenario for exactly that reason, because that's for others to debate. Mm-hmm. I simply look at it as the actual unfolding of what would happen is so horrific that I would give a lot of credit to all those brilliant thinkers out there in all the positions that you are referring to, doing all that they do, making their decisions. Maybe they will make their decisions in their own individual lanes with a little bit more clarity about the possibility that I report. And that, you know, trust the other, it's a different version of trust and verify, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, just read the worst case possible scenario that could happen and then reapproach your job with that in mind. Because there are so many capable people in Washington. There are so many capable people in all kinds of places of different governments. There's also a lot of, you know, not very reliable ones. And so let everybody do their job better would be my real, you know, position on that question.
You know, as someone, this is a very ecumenical podcast, so I have different people from different perspectives. So I'm very aware how ecosystems work. So I actually really like that answer, because your point here is a set of knowledge that's actually deeply important is real clarity about the consequences of nuclear war. So if we imagine in the 1950s, like these aren't, I mean, I actually love to ask you about some of the six scenarios you describe where there are accidents or real danger, but even during the 50s, you know, MacArthur famously discussed using nuclear weapons during the Korean War. Like the French famously requested that Eisenhower intervene at Dien Bien Phu in 1954 with like tactical nuclear weapons when it seemed as if the North Vietnamese were going to overwhelm them. There's a real serious conception of this is just something that was on the policy table. And gradually that disappeared. But I think knowing if you could go back in time and hand something to someone, it'd be like, no, seriously, MacArthur, you need to understand this. And I think also part of the reason why President Eisenhower shows good judgment during those Dien Bien Phu incidents is he has a conception of that reality. So last question on the nuclear prize, but not nuclear prize, nuclear issue before I kind of do a quick zoom out question. I would love to hear from you. What are the potential nuclear accidents or incidents that basically serve as the best warning against the idea that we could just manage the situation in perpetuity? Because it seems to me that those nuclear incidents are the response to my point about, oh, look, deterrence is working. You know, everyone's rational here. It's unthinkable. Therefore, it works. But it seems as if the existence of the incidents and the mistakes are actually the response to the idea that the status quo has worked versus is actually something we're just lucky.
Mm-hmm. Well, the most haunting almost nuclear incident that I can speak to came to me directly from former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, whom it happened to, right? And so in this book, I really go out of my way to list my sources up front. Usually that's something an author does in the back. But I did that on purpose in this book right up front so you can see. Because the situation is a hypothetical scenario, you can see, wow, she spoke to multiple former secretaries of defense, Obama's FEMA director, the United States of America's first cyber director, you know, the man who was in charge of America's nuclear subforce, and the list goes on, so that readers can understand this is coming from people in the upper echelons of nuclear command and control, people who would have been responsible for making these serious decisions in the event of nuclear war. And when Bill Perry described to me almost having to tell the President of the United States, which was President Carter at the time, that we were being attacked by nuclear weapons from Russia, you know, what he conveyed to me in his voice, in his whole being, really was stunning, because I could tell that all these decades later, it still made him shudder. And I describe it in the book in a simple paragraph in a section where I talk about, you know, the five or six or seven on the record, almost nuclear errors, you know, that could have led to nuclear war. But the one Perry was talking about was in 1979, and he was not the SecDef yet. He was the director of research and engineering at the Pentagon. And so he was kind of on the night watch, and he got a call saying, and the call, by the way, came from both the nuclear bunker under the Pentagon and the Stratcom bunker. Mm-hmm. They both were confirming that a nuclear attack was underway from both ICBMs from Soviet Russia and sub-launched ballistic missiles, which is like, that is the end game. And the way that Perry described it to me was he was kind of putting his head around, wrapping his head around how he was going to brief the president. And of course, at that point, you know, the president then has to move into this 6-minute window to make a decision of how many weapons to put on targets in a counterattack. And as Perry was deciding how he was going to bring this news to the president, he was informed that it was an error. And the actual error was that a VHS training tape demonstrating a nuclear war game scenario had been erroneously inserted into a machine at one of those two command bunkers, which were linked, and that's why everyone was seeing it. And the way he said it was like, it looked real because it was designed to look real, but it was a VHS training tape.
That's like out of depth. That's out of like Dr. Strangelove in terms of how stupidly obvious the details of what went wrong there really are. So, you know, one of my favorite questions to ask, you know, in this last section, eclectic writers such as yourself is kind of like, what is like the self-conception of your work? And you've written, you know, 6 books and they kind of not go all over the place, but you're writing about like Operation Paperclip and you're writing about the nuclear weapons program and you're writing about Area 51. Like you're writing about these very conspiracy adjacent places in a way that still clearly is speaking to experts, clearly explaining to people in a popular way how the world actually works. And I'm just curious how you would articulate your conception of what you're trying to do here, especially with like, I mean, you've been on Joe Rogan, like you speak to a really, really, really lay audience. Something I kind of like struggle with is like, I work at the University of Texas. I work at a think tank in DC. So like sometimes listeners will like reach out to me and they'll kind of ask me like conspiracy theory questions. They'll talk about like blood for oil in Iraq. And I'll have to be like, well, you know, I actually like work across the, you know, hall from Scooter Libby and I've talked to Scooter Libby about this. And like, it's actually a little more complicated. I'm just curious, like what your experience has been kind of like navigating these spaces during a low trust period where the functioning of the DOD and the Pentagon and the military are deeply important. I'm just curious what your kind of perspective is on that.
So as a investigative journalist who covers national security, I write about war, weapons, national security, and government secrets. And over the past 15 years of writing what is now 7 books, culture has certainly changed. What used to be considered more perhaps on the edges or the margins of what was known. For example, reporting on Operation Paperclip couldn't be more factual. These are actual documents declassified. I've sat how many hours in the National Archives, how many hours at the Bundesarchives in Germany. And yet you're absolutely right. With an increasing sort of oddity, a lot of these fact-based discussions have moved into realms where they are conflated with conspiracies, right? And I just use the Nazis as example because, and of course, because my other book, Area 51, where I interviewed 74, you know, spy pilots, CIA officers, Air Force officers, engineers, the first director of the Directorate of Science and Technology at the CIA couldn't have been more sort of in the mainstream lane of national security experts. And yet, because that book is called Area 51, you know, I am automatically sort of in the rabbit hole of UFO, ufology, all of those, as you say, conspiracies. And so I think what's interesting to me as a reporter is I just keep doing my job, which is to write books with the most interesting, most reliable, most trustworthy sources I can locate. Make sure that the last 100 or so pages of my book, which is the notes section, is as meticulously sourced as it can be, and allow room for journalists of the future, which are increasingly becoming lay people, to then continue to report the information. Because, you know, as a journalist, we all stand on the shoulders of so many great reporters that came before us, of so many great historians that dig into the archives to unearth certain documents. And I find that a lot of this present day sort of conspiratorial thinking and et cetera, and the culture wars, I just believe that that will all kind of, you know, even out, that there is an ebb and flow to people's interest in information that is somehow considered, you know, deeply secret. And when I think back of, you know, at the 1950s as a historian, when I put my historian hat on and I think of, like, you know, these slogans from the government, like popular living through chemistry or what, you know, this idea of like, just take your pill and ignore reality. I find on balance, maybe an overzealous, overcurious society really isn't that bad on balance.
I think actually we'll close here then. I would love to hear your reaction to the recent coverage of UFOs and congressional hearings, because I had Garrett Gaff on to talk about it. I did a bunch of research afterwards, and I'm honestly a little disappointed because I feel as if the narratives were a little shoddier than one would have hoped for. And a lot of the, like, there was a lot more hearsay than I think one would have expected given a lot of the headlines. That was just kind of like my personal reaction. I don't have like a dog in that fight. I'm curious, like, what your reaction, because like the most obvious like book pitch I'm sure you've gotten, since the past year has been like, your next book has to be about like UFOs and UAPs and like congressional hearings. So I'm curious, like, if you could close out on that topic.
As someone who has written extensively about the CIA and who has many, many, many sources in the agency, I am in of the position that I always approach UFO reports from the perspective of strategic deception. Now, I go back to my Area 51 book where I was able to unearth these documents demonstrating that the CIA was so interested in the public reporting the U-2 spy plane, an ultra-classified, ultra-secret program in the 1950s. And that when the CIA learned that regular people were reporting seeing UFOs when in fact it was the U-2 spy plane, they used this to their advantage and created a whole department around it, the Office of Strategic Deception. I write about that in Area 51. Does that mean that every UFO report in the United States is a U-2? No. But it does set a precedent for, I think, people to understand that the intelligence community, and remember, the CIA is one of 17 intelligence agencies in the United States. You know that, not a lot of people do. And so I see UFO ufology, I see it in the ether, and my first position is always to think of strategic deception. From there, it's a longer discussion, and maybe I come back on another podcast.
Great. Well, Annie, this has been super interesting, but also harrowing. Thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.